A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to know what the actual difference is between communism and socialism, and whether either has ever produced a truly successful society. And I'll be honest, Herman, I hear these terms thrown around constantly, often interchangeably, and I suspect most people couldn't give you a clean distinction if you asked.
They absolutely couldn't, and part of that is because the terms themselves have been fought over for 150 years. People use them as slurs, as badges of honor, as vague aspirations. But there is a real conceptual difference, and it matters.
Before we dive in, quick note. Today's script is being generated by DeepSeek V4 Pro. There, I said it.
Alright, so where do we start?
Let's start with the thing Daniel is actually asking. What distinguishes one from the other, and has either worked?
The cleanest distinction, and I want to be precise here because most casual definitions get this wrong, is that socialism, in its classical formulation, is about collective or social ownership of the means of production. Factories, land, resources, major industries. But it does not necessarily require the abolition of private property entirely, and it does not require a single-party state or the complete elimination of markets. Communism, as articulated by Marx and Engels, is the end state. It is a classless, stateless society where private property has been abolished entirely, and goods and services are distributed according to need. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. That is the communist principle. The state, in theory, withers away because there are no class antagonisms left to manage.
In the Marxian framework, socialism is the transitional phase between capitalism and communism. You seize the means of production. You establish what Marx called the dictatorship of the proletariat, which he meant as rule by the working class, not dictatorship in the modern sense. And you use that period to reorganize society until you can achieve full communism.
And this is where the historical record gets messy, because every self-described communist state, the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, North Korea, has been stuck in what they call the socialist phase. None of them ever claimed to have achieved full communism. They called themselves socialist republics, not communist republics.
Which is convenient, because it means you can always say, we're not there yet, when someone points out that your system doesn't look anything like the classless utopia you promised.
And that gets to the heart of the definitional problem. When people say communism in casual conversation, they're almost always referring to Soviet-style or Chinese-style authoritarian state socialism. But that is not what Marx described as communism. It is a particular historical implementation that borrowed Marxist language while building something quite different.
Let's nail down the practical distinctions. If I'm living under socialism, what does my daily life look like versus living under communism?
Under socialism as actually practiced. Think Sweden in the 1970s, or the Soviet Union, or modern Vietnam, you still have a state, you still have money, you still probably have some form of markets, even if heavily regulated. You receive wages for your labor, though they may be set by the state rather than by market forces. Major industries are state-owned or cooperatively owned. There is a robust welfare state, but you still go to work, you still get paid, you still buy groceries. In theory, none of that. No wages, because work is not compensated by payment. It is simply what you do, and in return, you take what you need from the common store. It is a society of abundance where the very concept of mine versus yours has faded away.
Which sounds lovely on paper and utterly impossible in practice, but we'll get to that.
But I want to flag something important here. There is a whole other tradition of socialism that is not Marxist at all. Democratic socialism, social democracy, these emerged in Western Europe and have very different intellectual roots.
This is the Scandinavian model, right?
So the social democratic tradition, think the British Labour Party, the German Social Democrats, the Nordic model, these movements explicitly rejected revolution. They said, we can achieve socialist goals through democratic means. Gradual reform, not violent overthrow. And critically, they preserved private property and market mechanisms. They didn't seize the factories, they taxed them.
Use the revenue to fund a generous welfare state.
Universal health care, free education, strong labor protections, public pensions, subsidized housing. The means of production remain largely in private hands, but the fruits of production are redistributed through taxation and social programs.
Is that socialism? Because if you ask someone on the American right, they'll say yes, absolutely. If you ask someone on the left, they might say no, that's just capitalism with a safety net.
Both have a point. If your definition of socialism is state ownership of the means of production, then no, the Nordic countries are not socialist. They are capitalist economies with large welfare states. But if your definition is broader, collective provision of basic needs, decommodification of essential services, then they have achieved certain socialist goals without socialist ownership.
I think this is where a lot of the confusion comes from. People use socialism to mean anything from full Soviet central planning to the government provides health care.
And that semantic slipperiness makes it very hard to evaluate whether socialism has worked. Because which socialism are we talking about?
Let's take Daniel's question head on. Have there been any successful societies based around either?
Let's start with what we can measure. If by successful we mean long-term stability, rising living standards, and some degree of popular legitimacy, then the Nordic social democracies have a strong case. Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland. These countries consistently rank at the top of global happiness indexes, human development indexes, and quality of life measures.
They're not socialist in the classical sense.
They're not, and I think that is actually the most interesting finding when you look at the historical record. The societies that have most successfully implemented socialist ideas, universal health care, free education, strong labor protections, reduced inequality, did so within democratic capitalist frameworks, not by abolishing capitalism.
What about the actually existing socialist states? The Soviet Union, Maoist China, Cuba?
This is where it gets grim. The Soviet Union industrialized rapidly, no question. It went from a largely agrarian feudal society to a nuclear superpower in about 40 years. Literacy rates soared. Women entered the workforce. There were genuine achievements.
At a staggering human cost.
The numbers are horrific. The Holodomor, the Great Purge, the Gulag system. We're talking tens of millions of deaths from famine, execution, and forced labor. And that's before we get to the economic inefficiency. Chronic shortages, no innovation, environmental devastation on a scale that's hard to comprehend.
I remember reading about the Aral Sea. The Soviets diverted the rivers that fed it to irrigate cotton fields, and the fourth largest lake in the world shrank to about 10% of its original size. It's now mostly desert.
One of the worst environmental disasters in history. And it wasn't an accident. It was the direct result of central planning that prioritized cotton production targets over every other consideration. No market feedback, no local accountability, just Moscow setting quotas.
The Soviet Union is not a great advertisement for communism or state socialism.
And yet, here's something that complicates the narrative. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, life expectancy for Russian men dropped by about 6 years in the first half of the 1990s. Poverty rates skyrocketed. The social safety net vanished overnight. For all the Soviet system's brutality and inefficiency, its collapse was also catastrophic for millions of people.
Which is not an argument for Soviet communism. It's an argument that transitions between economic systems are devastating, and that even terrible systems provide some forms of stability that people rely on.
And that's a point that often gets lost in ideological debates. You can think a system is morally abhorrent and economically unsustainable, and still recognize that dismantling it overnight causes immense human suffering.
What about China?
China is the most interesting case because they figured out something the Soviets never did. After Mao died in 1976, Deng Xiaoping took over and basically said, "We're keeping the Communist Party in charge, but we're introducing market mechanisms. Special economic zones, private enterprise, foreign investment." They called it socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Which is a fancy way of saying state capitalism with authoritarian politics.
That's exactly what it is. And by the numbers, it has been the most successful poverty reduction program in human history. The World Bank estimates that China has lifted something like 800 million people out of poverty since the reforms began. Life expectancy is up. Literacy is near universal. They built modern infrastructure at a staggering pace.
Again, at what cost?
Mass surveillance, forced labor in Xinjiang, suppression of political dissent, the one-child policy and its legacy of demographic imbalance and human rights abuses. The social credit system. The crackdown on Hong Kong. So you have to ask, is economic growth and poverty reduction success if it comes with that?
I think that's the core question Daniel is getting at. What does successful even mean?
If your metric is purely economic, GDP growth, poverty reduction, industrialization, then China under Communist Party rule has been extraordinarily successful. If your metric includes political freedom, human rights, and personal autonomy, it has been a catastrophe.
What about smaller scale examples?
Cuba is fascinating. The revolution in 1959 produced genuine gains in literacy and healthcare. Cuba's doctor-to-patient ratio is among the best in the world. They developed their own COVID vaccines. Life expectancy is comparable to the United States. The economy has been a disaster. Chronic shortages of basic goods, rationing that has gone on for decades, wages that are laughably low, massive dependence on first Soviet subsidies and then Venezuelan oil, and political repression. No free press, no free elections, political prisoners, the whole apparatus of a one-party state.
You get decent healthcare and you can't criticize the government.
That's the trade-off. And Cubans have been voting with their feet for decades. The diaspora is enormous relative to the island's population.
Let's talk about the democratic socialist experiments. You mentioned the Nordics. Are there other examples?
The post-war British consensus is a good one. After World War II, the Labour government under Clement Attlee nationalized major industries, coal, steel, railways, utilities, and created the National Health Service. This was genuine socialism in the ownership sense, achieved through democratic elections. For a while, the NHS is still wildly popular and is probably the single most beloved institution in British life. But the nationalized industries struggled. They were inefficient, overstaffed, resistant to innovation. Margaret Thatcher privatized most of them in the 1980s, and even the Labour Party eventually abandoned its commitment to nationalization.
The democratic socialist experiment in Britain partially succeeded in healthcare and largely failed in industrial ownership.
I think that's fair, and it points to a pattern. When socialist policies focus on decommodifying essential services, healthcare, education, pensions, they tend to be durable and popular. When they focus on state ownership of productive industry, they tend to fail.
Why is that?
I think there are a few reasons. One is the information problem. Markets aggregate vast amounts of dispersed knowledge through prices. A central planner in London or Moscow cannot possibly know what every factory should produce, what every consumer wants, what every supplier can provide. Hayek wrote about this in The Use of Knowledge in Society. It's one of the most important papers in 20th century economics.
The planner is flying blind.
And the second problem is incentives. When a factory manager in a state-owned enterprise gets no reward for innovation and no penalty for inefficiency, what do you think happens? You get stagnation, waste, and corruption. The Soviet Union had a joke about this. We pretend to work, and they pretend to pay us.
That's bleak.
It's bleak, but it captures something real. Without market incentives, productivity collapses. And without productivity, you can't fund the generous welfare state that socialists want.
There's a tension within socialism itself. You want to redistribute wealth, but the wealth has to come from somewhere.
And this is where the Nordic model is clever. They didn't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. They kept market capitalism for production and used taxation and social programs for distribution. They separated the engine from the steering wheel.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about successful societies. The Nordics seem to have figured out a hybrid that works.
The Nordic model emerged in very specific conditions. Small, ethnically homogeneous populations. High levels of social trust. Strong civic institutions. Existing industrial bases. It's not clear how well it scales to larger, more diverse societies.
Even the Nordics have been pulling back. Sweden had a major financial crisis in the early 1990s and reformed its welfare state significantly. They're still generous by American standards, but they're not the same as they were in the 1970s.
The trend across Europe has been toward liberalization. More market mechanisms, more private provision, more individual choice. The socialist high-water mark was probably the 1970s, and it has been receding ever since.
Let's talk about what went wrong ideologically, because I think there's a deeper failure here beyond just economics. Marxism predicted that industrial workers would be the revolutionary class. The proletariat would rise up, overthrow the bourgeoisie, and establish the dictatorship of the proletariat. But that never happened in the advanced capitalist countries.
It didn't. The revolutions happened in Russia, China, Cuba, Vietnam, all largely agrarian, pre-industrial societies. Not where Marx predicted.
In the industrialized West, workers didn't want revolution. They wanted higher wages, shorter hours, safer conditions, and a voice in the workplace. And they got those things through unions, labor parties, and democratic reforms, not through smashing the state.
Which is a pretty strong argument that democratic capitalism is more responsive to working class demands than revolutionary socialism ever was. The countries where workers are best off are not the ones that had communist revolutions. They're the ones that had strong labor movements operating within democratic systems.
What about the moral argument for socialism? The idea that it's simply unjust for a small number of people to own the vast majority of wealth while others struggle.
I think that moral intuition is powerful, and it's why socialist ideas keep resurfacing even after the failures of actually existing socialism. People look at billionaires and homelessness existing side by side and think, this can't be right.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong that extreme inequality is a problem. Where they go wrong is in assuming that the solution is to abolish markets and private property rather than to regulate them more effectively.
The diagnosis is often correct, but the prescription is flawed.
That's my view, and I think the historical record supports it. The societies that have most successfully reduced poverty and improved living standards for ordinary people have been mixed economies. Capitalist production with strong social safety nets and progressive taxation.
Let's talk about Venezuela, because that's a more recent example that often comes up in these debates.
Venezuela is a cautionary tale. Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999 with a socialist platform, riding a wave of anger at inequality and corruption. He had massive oil revenues to work with. He nationalized industries, imposed price controls, expanded social programs.
For a while, it looked like it was working.
Poverty did decline in the early years, but the whole thing was built on oil. When oil prices collapsed, the entire edifice crumbled. Price controls led to shortages. Nationalized industries became unproductive. Inflation hit absurd levels. We're talking millions of percent. Millions of Venezuelans fled the country.
It's one of the largest displacement crises in the world, and it happened in a country with the largest proven oil reserves on the planet.
Which tells you something about the relationship between natural resource wealth and economic management. Having resources is not enough. You need institutions that can manage them competently. And the Chavez-Maduro model systematically destroyed those institutions.
Is there any example of a resource-rich socialist state that managed its resources well?
But again, Norway is not socialist in the ownership sense. It's a constitutional monarchy with a market economy. What Norway did was create a sovereign wealth fund. They took the oil revenue and invested it for the long term rather than spending it immediately on patronage and consumption.
The difference between Norway and Venezuela is not socialism versus capitalism. It's good governance versus catastrophic governance.
And that's a point that gets lost. The economic system matters, but institutions matter at least as much. Rule of law, property rights, independent courts, a free press, competitive elections. These are what prevent resource wealth from becoming a curse.
Let's circle back to communism specifically. Has any society ever achieved anything close to what Marx envisioned?
And I think it's worth being honest about that. No society has achieved a classless, stateless, moneyless society of abundance. Every attempt has either collapsed, reformed into something else, or ossified into authoritarian state capitalism with a communist label.
Is that because the idea is impossible, or because the attempts were flawed?
I think there are reasons to believe it's impossible at scale. The information problem we mentioned, no central authority can process enough information to run a complex modern economy. The incentive problem, Without some form of material reward, people don't innovate or work hard. And the power problem, if you concentrate economic and political power in the same hands, you get tyranny.
The power problem seems especially intractable. The whole Marxist theory says the state will wither away. But in practice, giving the state control over the entire economy makes it more powerful, not less.
People who have that kind of power don't voluntarily give it up. The withering away of the state is a fantasy. What actually happens is the state becomes the employer, the landlord, the censor, the police, and the judge all in one. There's no exit, no appeal, no alternative.
Which is why communist states have all been dictatorships.
Not by accident. When the state owns everything, political opposition is indistinguishable from economic sabotage. If you criticize the government, you're not just a dissident, you're threatening the entire economic system. So, the response is always harsh.
What about smaller-scale experiments? Communes? Intentional communities? Kibbutzim?
The kibbutz movement in Israel is actually a fascinating case study. These were genuinely communist communities, collective ownership, no private property, equal distribution, communal child-rearing, and they worked for decades.
I was going to bring those up. What made them work?
The ability to leave. And critically, they existed within a larger market economy. The kibbutz could sell its agricultural and industrial products on the market. It wasn't a closed system.
They were communist islands in a capitalist sea.
And that's very different from trying to run an entire national economy on communist principles. The kibbutzim also evolved significantly over time. Most have privatized to some degree, introduced differential wages, allowed private property. The pure communist model didn't survive contact with generational change.
Younger members wanted to keep what they earned.
And once you have enough people who want that, the system either adapts or collapses. Most kibbutzim adapted.
Even in the most favorable conditions, small, voluntary, ideologically committed communities, full communism didn't last more than a couple of generations.
That's the record. And I think that tells us something important about human nature. People want to provide for their families. They want to be rewarded for their efforts. They want some degree of autonomy and privacy. Systems that deny these things can persist for a while through ideological commitment or coercion, but they don't last.
Let's talk about the democratic socialist resurgence in the last decade or so. Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. There's been a real revival of socialist language in Western politics.
And I think it's driven by genuine problems. Rising inequality, housing costs, student debt, healthcare access. Young people in particular feel like the system isn't working for them.
What they're proposing isn't really socialism in the classical sense, is it?
It's not. When Bernie Sanders talks about democratic socialism, he's talking about something closer to the Nordic model or the New Deal. Medicare for all, free college, stronger unions, higher taxes on the wealthy. He's not calling for the abolition of private property or the nationalization of all industry.
It's social democracy with a socialist label.
And I think the label matters because it creates unnecessary confusion and gives opponents an easy line of attack. If you call yourself a socialist, people are going to associate you with Venezuela and the Soviet Union, even if your actual policies are closer to Denmark.
Is that a branding problem or a substantive one?
A bit of both. I think some on the left want to reclaim the word socialism and detach it from its authoritarian associations. But I'm skeptical that's possible. The word carries too much historical baggage.
Where does this leave us with Daniel's question?
I think the honest answer is that neither communism nor socialism, in their classical, maximalist forms, have produced a successful society. Communism has never been achieved, and every attempt has produced authoritarianism and economic failure. Full-state socialism has a very poor track record, with the partial exception of small-scale, time-limited experiments.
Socialist ideas. The welfare state. Public provision of essential services, progressive taxation, labor protections, have been successfully integrated into capitalist democracies and have dramatically improved living standards.
That's the synthesis. The most successful societies have been mixed economies that combine market mechanisms for production with strong state intervention for distribution and social protection. Pure capitalism produces brutal inequality. Pure socialism produces stagnation and tyranny. The sweet spot is somewhere in between.
That sweet spot looks different in different places. What works in Denmark might not work in the United States or India or Nigeria.
Context matters enormously. Culture, history, institutions, demographics, all of these shape what's possible. There's no one-size-fits-all model.
I think there's also a lesson here about humility and political ideology. The 20th century was full of people who were absolutely certain they had the blueprint for a perfect society, and they were willing to kill millions of people to implement it.
The road to hell is paved with 5-year plans.
That's good. Is that yours?
I think I heard it somewhere, but it captures something real. The more detailed and comprehensive your plan for remaking society, the more likely you are to produce a catastrophe.
Because reality is more complex than any plan can capture.
Because plans ignore the thing that Hayek emphasized, the dispersed, local, practical knowledge that ordinary people have about their own circumstances. The central planner doesn't know what the farmer knows about his soil, what the factory worker knows about her machine, what the consumer knows about her preferences.
The knowledge required to run an economy doesn't exist in any one place. It's distributed across millions of minds.
Markets are, for all their flaws, the best mechanism we've found for aggregating that dispersed knowledge. Prices convey information about scarcity, demand, and opportunity cost in a way that no committee ever could.
That doesn't mean markets solve everything.
Of course not. Markets don't provide public goods like national defense or basic research. They don't account for externalities like pollution. They don't ensure a fair distribution of resources. That's why you need a state. The question is not markets versus state. It's how to combine them intelligently.
That's a question that requires constant adjustment and experimentation, not a one-time ideological commitment.
Which is why I'm suspicious of anyone who claims to have the final answer, whether they're a free market fundamentalist or a revolutionary socialist. The world is too complicated for final answers.
All right, let's try to summarize for Daniel. Communism and socialism are distinct concepts, though they're related and often confused. Socialism, broadly, means social ownership of the means of production, and it comes in many varieties, from Soviet central planning to Nordic welfare states. Communism, in Marx's framework, is the classless, stateless end state that socialism is supposed to lead to, but no society has ever achieved it.
As for success, the full state socialist model has a dismal record. The Soviet Union, Maoist China, Cuba, Venezuela. Some achieved rapid industrialization or improvements in specific metrics like literacy, but all came with massive human costs and most eventually collapsed or reformed toward market systems.
The democratic socialist or social democratic experiments. The Nordic countries, post-war Britain's NHSS, have been more successful and more durable, but they kept market mechanisms and private property intact. They socialized distribution, not production.
The most successful poverty reduction in human history, China since the late 1970s, came not from orthodox communism, but from market reforms introduced by a communist party that was pragmatically willing to abandon its own ideology in favor of what worked.
Which is maybe the ultimate lesson. Ideology is a poor substitute for pragmatism.
I'd go further. Ideology is actively dangerous when it prevents you from seeing what's actually happening. The Soviet planners who kept increasing grain quotas even as famine spread, they weren't evil necessarily. They were trapped in an ideological framework that couldn't process the reality in front of them.
The map became more real than the territory.
Corn. One last thing I want to touch on. Daniel asked about successful societies, and we've mostly talked about economic metrics. But I think there's a deeper question about what kind of society people actually want to live in.
The Soviet Union provided full employment, free healthcare, free education, cheap housing. By some material metrics, it was successful. But people risked their lives to escape it. They wrote Samizdat literature. They listened to banned radio stations. They yearned for the freedom to say what they thought and travel where they wanted.
That's not nothing. Human beings are not just stomachs that need to be fed. We want dignity, autonomy, meaning. Systems that treat people as interchangeable units to be administered will always fail at the human level, even if they hit their production targets.
Which is why any definition of successful society has to include liberty, not just prosperity.
And that's where the communist and state socialist models fail most completely. They may provide bread, but they take away everything else.
All right. I think we've given Daniel a pretty thorough answer. Communism and socialism are distinct. Neither has been fully successful in its pure form. The most successful societies borrow elements from both the socialist and capitalist traditions and adapt them to local conditions.
If there's one thing to take away, it's that the labels matter less than the outcomes. Call it whatever you want. What matters is whether people are free, prosperous, and able to live dignified lives.
Oh, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a German chemist analyzing mineral samples from the Pamir Mountains in what is now Tajikistan discovered a compound that, when exposed to ultraviolet light, emitted a faint green phosphorescence. He proposed that this proved the existence of a previously unknown element he called Pamirium. It was later found to be contaminated quartz.
Of course it was.
The things we discover by accident and then undiscover by better science.
Thank you, Hilbert. And thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, head to myweirdprompts.com or find us on Spotify. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.